Faith Factor Impact, episode 20. Hey everybody, welcome to Faith Factor Impact, where we hang out with today's top nonprofit thought leaders to get refueled, reconnected, and inspiration. So let's go.
We spend so much of our lives trying to fit into what we think people want, as opposed to really owning who we are.
Hello, hello, everybody. Jay Everline here, your host, and I am so excited in the house with my main man, Carl Settles. Hey, Carl, so excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Carl Settles is the founder and executive director of E4Youth, an organization that helps bridge the gap between underserved youth and creative commercial arts careers. E4Youth has nurtured, trained, and mentored over 2,000 students since its inception. Carl is over 20 years in high technology as a developer and producer and was recently featured by Microsoft's national ad campaign as one of their people of action. Carl is a top-notch thought leader who's doing work that matters and making an impact. So, Carl, we like to start the top of our show off with a reflection. I'd like to hand it over to you and let you share that reflection to get us going.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we really preach and try to live as an organization is that great educators teach students and not subjects. And what that really boils down to is that before you can really reach or inspire someone, you have to be able to listen. And a big part of our methodology and the curriculum that we've developed and how we provide professional development for teachers is really helping them become better listeners and facilitators so that they can really understand where a kid is coming from, and then they can make recommendations about how they're going to help propel that young person's life forward.
Mm. Thanks for kicking us off with that, Carl. And, you know, I shared a little bit at the top of the show about you, your accomplishments, E4Youth, what you're doing, and that's really good. But I also want to kind of have you, if you would, tell us a little bit about Carl and stuff maybe that, you know, we can't find on your public profile. I want to kind of get to know you as a person. What makes you
sure.
Carl?
Well, I'm a second-generation college graduate. Father had a PhD in psychology from University of Texas. My mother had a master's degree in accounting. And it was always expected that I would go to college. Of course I did. And I actually ended up studying music. And I've always been creative, but I've also had, I guess, some technical aptitude. But I actually have a music degree when I graduated from college here in Austin, Texas. And my first jobs out of college were actually teaching. I taught second grade reading and math in a Title I program in Killeen, Texas. And then I taught the sixth grade science and history for 5 years here in Austin at another Title I school. And those years just out of college had a huge impact on me. First of all, it was, I guess, reconciling my destiny that if you would have talked to me 6 months before I graduated from college and told me that I was going to be teaching, I wouldn't have believed you, but alas, that's where I ended up. And I'm glad that I ended up there and I got to, work with students and really start to see firsthand, the challenges that they go through. But during that time, I was also a professional musician. I started an after school enrichment club or program that was focused on technology for youth, had kids coding in HTML. This was back in, I guess, the mid-90s that we did that. And from there, I got into technology myself and ended up in the software world. And was able to leverage my audio background and actually became the director of audio at an educational software company. And I really kind of had a dream job. I was essentially doing the modern day version of Schoolhouse Rock. I was writing songs and other people writing educational songs and voiceover talent. And I did that for a couple of years and really enjoyed it and found that I had a knack for production. And about that time, the economy was really faltering and I got laid off with a bunch of other folks and wanted to stay in that world of production. And that's when I discovered advertising. The issue for me at that time, when I tried to make that lateral move into advertising, was that I didn't have the right type of portfolio. I didn't really know anybody that was in advertising. And it was really difficult for me to make that transition. And as I went through that process, I kept reflecting about the students that I worked with. If I was a second generation college graduate, and I didn't know about the opportunities, how would they know? And, you know, part of the issue with advertising and media is that there's, even though America is more and more diverse, media, particularly media ownership, has become less and less diverse. And when you look at advertising, there's a lack of diversity. And so my folks didn't know that opportunity existed. And therefore, I didn't really know that opportunity existed. Mm-hmm. So looking at the kids that I worked with, just began to reflect on that and wanted to eventually came to the idea of, well, how can I start to address that? And that was the genesis of what is now E4Youth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I really like how you unpack that story. And one of the things that I continue to see with individuals like you who founded a nonprofit organization is there's this trend where there's a point along your way where you start to make the connection between kind of what you're doing professionally, what you enjoy, and then you start to see a need that is in your local community or in the community at large, and you begin to think through kind of how to address that. And so I'm curious, like, what you could have taken that thought and went a lot of different directions, not necessarily, hey, I'm going to go start a nonprofit, but what was it about that need that you saw? And what was kind of the genesis behind, you know, saying, I'm going to do this? Because not everybody goes there, right? There are many people who may see that right. need, but don't take that step. What was that for you?
Wow. Well, that's a multi-dimensional type of question. I think the time that I spent in the classroom was really impactful. Having a creative background, working as a professional musician, doing graphic design, being in technology as well. All of those things, the sum of those experiences kind of led me to where I'm at now. One of the things that that came into play is that a guy I went to high school with, we played football together. He actually started what's now a national organization called the National Diversity Council. And he started initially with the Texas Diversity Council. And so I began talking to him a couple of years prior to me really making the leap. It's funny, one of the things that really impacted me is that he was working in the corporate world and he had this idea about promoting diversity in corporate America. And a lot of people looked at him crazy, but he pulled it off. And actually one of the pivotal moments for me was that I was going to a conference that he was holding, and I actually was Spike Lee's escort for the day. I picked him up from the airport and I drove him to the hotel where he gave a keynote talk, and so I got to hang out with him.
Nice.
And at that same conference, Bill Clinton's former press secretary, Dee Dee Myers, was speaking. I think Jeb Bush was speaking. All these heavyweights from all over the political spectrum were there, along with Spike Lee. And this is something that somebody that I went to high school with, that they started. And so that struck me. And when Spike Lee was talking, he said some things that really hit home for me. He said, some of you, first of all, he talked about how lucky he was to do something that he loved for a living. And he said to the audience members, some of you may be doing things right now that you may not completely enjoy. That really hit home for me. And I guess I was also approaching 40 at the time, so maybe a midlife crisis. But that stuck with me, and I had this example of my friend who also offered to help and mentor me. And I was working at a educational software company, managing, producing interactive projects, and they were shutting down. And during the meeting where they were letting us know, telling us about how that was going to happen, I literally walked out of the meeting and went into the hallway, and I called my friend from high school and said, you know, I'm ready. And I drove and visited him that weekend. And that was really kind of the genesis of what pushed me over the edge, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'd done a lot of work in the nonprofit world just out of college. And I kind of soured on it. And I wanted to stay in the for-profit world, and I was in the startup world and all that stuff. But maybe it's because I saw the success that he was having, that I was willing to give it another try. And eventually I landed on E4Youth, and that's where we've been at for the past 5 years, really focused on helping creative youth.
That is such an awesome experience that you had, and it really dovetails well into my next question for you. You know, tenet of our show is this idea that that folks that really get into this work, like you and you're doing, impacting your community, have what we call this faith factor. It's this why, right? And so when you think about your faith factor, your why, when you get up in the morning and you know, at either, you know, 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and you're starting to go about the work that you're doing, what's that why for you? Why do you keep getting up every day and going back to this? Kind of give us a face for what that means for you.
I was a creative kid. I had a lot of support growing up. And unfortunately, in our schools, creative kids are ignored in our schools. If you have means and some support, then you get private lessons. Your parents make an effort to get you exposure to those things that you're into. They make more of it, or have better resources to be able to expose you to those things, I should say. You know, you may have an interest in film, and because of the social network that you're in, you may get exposure to folks that are already in that realm. And you start to see how the sausage is made. You develop relationships with the people that are in there. And so you know something about it, and it's something that eventually you have a higher probability of success, not because you have more talent. It's because you have more access. And I guess I reflect back to several of the students that, you know, there are always students that you have as an indicator, or young people that you come into contact with that stick with you, that you remember that kid, and you remember that they were brilliant or they had talent, but there were forces outside of their control that were, you know, really preventing them from reaching their full potential. And I guess what drives me is that I see those students when I walk into a classroom. I see those students all over the place. There's there's no shortage of talent. There's a shortage of opportunity. And I guess what drives me is I want those young creative youth, particularly those young creative youth of color, to know that there are opportunities that are out there, that exist out there, that they can take advantage of, where they can really truly flourish and be a success and feel good about who they are and what they're doing. I think, I have one of the people that mentors with our organization. He started started off as an Instagram account. It's called Risk Happy. And the whole idea is that people would rather stay miserable than risk being happy. You know, I really feel like ultimately that's the choice that I made, is that I wasn't living a bad life. You know, I wasn't miserable in the software world, but I wasn't truly happy either. And I would rather do something that inspires me than just try to get along.
Ultimately. You know, going through that personal discovery and asking what can be really tough questions to ask yourself, right? I mean, some of us find ourselves in a situation, like you said, it wasn't like you were miserable. You were in a place where, you know, you could pay your bills and you had some left over, and it wasn't like the work that you were doing, you hated it all together, but it didn't awaken the true depths of who you were, who you wanted to be, and what you wanted to be doing with your time. And it takes a real leap of faith, a real leap of courage, to step into that space. And I can't applaud you any more than taking that leap. And now here you are today, impacting hundreds of thousands of youth and their families, by the way, right? We're just talking about the students that you're impacting, but think about the change and the impact that this is going to have on the families that are also involved in the programs that you have going on. So, Carl, thank you, sir. Thank you for that why and letting that drive you every day to keep doing what you're doing. It's a much needed thing.
Absolutely.
So with all of this success that you've experienced and continue to experience, you know, sometimes that success can be intimidating to others that are trying to find their way and think that I could never be a Carl. I can't see myself stepping out and doing something as courageous as he did. And so we like to get into what we call this valley moment. So to help people really kind of understand that it hadn't always been rosy, right? I mean, you hinted on this a little bit. You lost your job previously, but can you kind of dig into a valley moment that you had that really changed some things about your perspective? And what was that experience for you?
There was a point where I was in the technology world, and I would get a job, and I would start to do relatively well, and then a lot of times for things beyond my control, it would evaporate. There was a time, over the course of 7 years, I had been laid off five times, all through no fault of my own. You know, ran out of funding, business was closing, entire divisions of a company were eliminated. And we spend so much of our lives trying to fit into what we think people want, as opposed to really owning who we are. That's something that I really had to come to terms with. You know, one of the things I do now with young people is I have them do a personal SWOT analysis. So I have them identify their strengths, their weaknesses, their opportunities, and their threats. And I really try and help them. You know, what starts to happen is that fear paralyzes us. And no matter who we are, there are certain things that we have, attributes that are strengths that if we can really fully recognize those things and build on them, those are going to really propel us forward in life. And that fear really keeps you from being able to take a full assessment of what those things are. And I think for a period in my life, I was just trying to get by. I was trying to fit into somebody else's mold rather than embracing what I had that was truly a value. Anytime you lose a job, I think there's even like a grieving process for losing a job.
Right.
Denial and, you know, anger and, you know, all of those things. And it's really hard to, again, focus on what you do have control over rather than those things that are not within your control. And so if you can do a full assessment of what assets you do have and build on those, ultimately that's going to get you a lot further.
Man,
I don't know if that answers your question.
It completely answers my question. And, you know, I really like you mentioned this before when we've talked, this personal SWOT. I mean, taking the youth through that, obviously, if you can get started on that personal SWOT early on in life, it sets you up so much better for the future. But there are some people listening today that need to do a personal SWOT. That is SWOT, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, and use that as Carl uses with the youth to figure out who you are. What are the things that you have to offer that are value?
You know, I'll have students do a SWOT and they'll talk about their threats and like they'll say, I've got haters. Well, you know, do you really have haters? You know, are there really people out there like just plotting to like hold you back? You know, and if there are, does it really behoove you to focus on them?
Yeah.
You know, or they may say, not threats. So I have a lot of kids that are creatives. Let's say that they are a musician. And they'll say, well, one of my threats is other musicians.
Mm.
Well, maybe those other musicians could be an opportunity for you.
Look at that.
You know, I think it's all in how you look at it. That makes all the difference. Technology has lowered the bar to entry into many, many different realms. You know, for instance, something like Uber. Well, is it a tech company? Is it a transportation company? I think it's a matter of you have to really look at who you are and really break it down and really question yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody says to me, I'm good at this, and I'll go, okay, well, can you give me an example that shows me that you're good at that?
Right.
Yeah. What's tangible that says, hey, but you're actually good at that. But if you can validate that, then you got something,
mm-hmm.
right? I'll ask a young person, so where do you see yourself 5 years from now? And a lot of times they're at a loss. Frankly, a lot of adults are at a loss. That question. But if you don't do that personal analysis, you don't know where you're at. How can you know if you've gotten anywhere? If you don't do some analysis where you're at and then set some goals, then you don't know if you've made any progress or not.
Absolutely.
Because you've just been kind of flailing, really. And I find myself asking myself those questions all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I went through this entrepreneurial fellowship not too long ago, and one of the things they said is that you have to test your assumptions, because we assume things that may or may not necessarily be true. A lot of times we'll build so many expectations based on these assumptions. Based on just one assumption, where we build all these other things on top of that one assumption, then that's actually not true, and then everything that we've built on top of that comes toppling down.
Yeah.
And I really feel like we collectively as people, we do that all the time. You have to be more careful about validating what are you good at? Mm-hmm. What am I not good at? And I went through that with my organization. You know, I'm not a finance guy. And that's okay.
Right.
You know, but there's some stuff that I'm really great at.
Yeah.
And so I need to focus on that and then find some other folks or maybe some software or some other resources that are going to help me with those things I'm not quite as good at. And having that sober analysis can make a huge difference in how fast you get to where you want to go.
Carl, this is such good stuff. And I so love that you have this perspective and you have an abundance mentality as opposed to a scarcity mentality. There's so much that you just said and we talked about that I can unpack. Some of the work that you're doing personally, but also in your organization, and how might you kind of position that so that we can learn from that and start to think about our organizations, the nonprofit leaders that are out there listening right now to this conversation, how they might start to reframe some of those things that you mentioned about strengths and partnering. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think I look at what my organization is doing is that we're building an ecosystem. And because we're dealing with education in schools, it's a very, very multi-layered type of environment that we're dealing with. So I'm dealing with students, I'm dealing with their parents, I'm dealing with teachers and administrators. Then I'm also dealing with colleges. I have to leverage relationships with them, and also I have to leverage relationships with employers as well. So it's trying to figure out once you start to identify what your strengths are, then you have to figure out, well, how can I leverage those within the ecosystem, the socio-political ethos that you exist in at that time? How can you leverage that? And who are your natural allies where you can partner in? You get what you need out of it, and they're able to get something that they need out of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
For me, for a long time, I was, even though I was brought up in or cut my teeth in technology, I realized that most of my allies were actually in the creative world, in the advertising world. And I was going, for a long time, the first half of my organization, was really spent chasing after money for STEM or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But I came to a realization that, well, my relationships are with people in advertising. And I even had some of them sit me down and say, you know what, you're trying to solve all the world's problems, but we want you to solve this problem. We want you to solve this diversity problem in our industry. And that was at once alarming and comforting for me. But once I really started to focus, that's when things really started to come together. And so you just have to just be aware. One of the things we do is after school enrichment and creative outlets for kids. And there are lots of organizations that do that. But the thing that differentiates us is our relationship with employers. We have a very, very strong job shadowing program. When we work with employers, we don't say, hey, you need to hire a kid for 20 hours a week. We'll say, can this kid come by your business 2 hours a week? And that other 18 hours, we are going to curate their experiences so that they can get the most out of that experience. You know, and so when we go, we're talking to employers, we've spent a lot of time listening to them and really trying to understand what it is that they want, and also help being able to communicate on their behalf to the educators about the types of skills and experiences that they actually want their employees to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in terms of working with educators, what I'm really trying to help them do is to help them build rapport with the students and get the kids motivated. And that listening piece, teaching students rather than subjects, cannot be underestimated. Because if you start to understand what really motivates the kid, and also I think there's this thing of back when I was in school, the teacher was kind of seen as they know everything. And we know now, well, a lot of us know now, or at least think now with the internet, that that's not true. Nobody can be an expert on everything. And with that access to the internet and to all these professional people, is that the teacher should be the master facilitator. That is really the most important skill that they can have in the classroom, is being able to facilitate the right types of experiences for their students. And that's going to change depending upon who's in the room at that time. And that's a hard thing for teachers, schools, to really fathom. I mean, you know, maybe I'm a little antithetical. So people talk about we don't have enough science teachers in schools. And on one hand, I see that. But from an economic standpoint, if somebody goes and gets an advanced science degree and they can make, or a technology degree, and they can make $80K coming out of college within their field of study versus $40K in the classroom, you know, are we really ever going to get there in
right.
terms of the numbers of those teachers? But if you say, hey, what we need are facilitators and then access to those people that have those extra keys, and then the equation starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in terms of relationships, I try to have a more open mind in terms of how can we solve the problems that we're experiencing, particularly in our education system.
Yeah. Man, Carl, there's so much good stuff there. I want to go back to something that you talked about, because I think this is so key. And this is going to dovetail right into our conversation. I want to talk to you before we let you go about leadership. And that is this idea. And I've held on to this quote that I heard, and I want to plug it in right here. And it kind of sums up for me what you talked about in terms of the evolution of E for Youth and your focus. And that is this idea of going 10 feet deep and 1 inch wide, right? Just really mm-hmm. digging deep into that one thing. That what's that thing that you're going to do that you're going to be best at, and stay in that space. Cause that, and Carl, you can validate this or not. That's the sweet spot, right? And we talked about this before, right? Those of us in the nonprofit mm-hmm. space, we want to save the world. We want to save the world. And you can perhaps accomplish some of that, but not being all things to all people. And just figuring out what are those strengths, what are those things that you absolutely bring to the table that nobody else can do better than you. And the only way that you can really get better at that thing is you do it over and over and over and over and over again. And that's hard for us to really accept. And you said it was quite a relief for you, which maybe it could be a relief for some other people who may be thinking to themselves, you mean I don't have to do all of that stuff? No, you don't. Figure out what's the thing that you're going to do. And to the extent that you can do more than one or two things and have at it, but be really good at it.
Yeah. You know, for me, it was recognizing that my sweet spot was in the creative space. I have aptitude for that, but because of all of the other experiences that I have, you know, I don't discount any of the experiences that I have. All of those cumulative experiences come into play into what I do now. But now that I'm more comfortable with where I exist in the ecosystem, I'm better able to leverage where I'm at, but also those other experiences that I've had make it easier for me to connect with other people and also help them see how they fit within that larger context of what we're trying to accomplish.
Such good stuff. So let's kind of keep going down this kind of unfolding of what I'm hearing is these leadership tenets, these leadership attributes that you keep speaking to. And can you talk to me about, as we think about the differences between good leaders and great leaders, what are those things that you have found to be that effective leaders and great leaders really do? What are some of those things that maybe you could share with us some insight?
The people that I've admired the most, they didn't necessarily have to talk a lot in order to have their impact. But when they spoke, they spoke with a certain amount of intensity and purpose that carried much more weight than other folks that just kind of drone on and on. I may be one of those droners myself, but you know, I think it's not what you say, it's what you do.
Right.
And the great leaders are able to do that. And I think also there's the aspect of being able to create a sandbox for other people to play in, where you help people understand the vision and then start to help them see where they fit within that vision and have that be something that they can fully embrace and take ownership of themselves while contributing to that larger vision. That's what I would say.
That's good stuff. Great leaders do, man. They do. They walk the talk. So, you know, one of the other things that we have found to be very valuable is we paint this picture, which I think is very good to paint a picture of what great looks like. But there also can be, I think, significant value in identifying the things leaders, you know, we should encourage leaders not to do. And the reason that I really turn that upside down and talk about the don'ts is not to be negative, but sometimes there's this cognitive dissonance, right? And we don't see the blind spots that we might have. And so I would be interested in your perspective. What are some of the things that you've seen and you'd be like, don't do that, right? Don't eat from that tree.
You know, we're all flawed. And I'm the first to say that, you know, I have my flaws and I make mistakes all the time. I think not being open to criticism or feedback, maybe the more euphemistic way to say that, you know, I don't claim to know everything. And when you try to purport yourself as knowing everything, nobody can know everything. So eventually you're going to come off as really a fraud.
Right.
And so don't claim to know everything. And unfortunately, I've been in situations at times where maybe I had a boss or a leader that really tried to micromanage what I was trying to do. And it left me feeling unsure about what my role was. And also, I feel like there are times where when you feel like you're being micromanaged, you also can kind of abdicate your responsibility in some regards. Like, well, where you feel like what you do doesn't really matter. I think what that really boils down to is that you have leaders that you have to continue to develop that capacity to grow. And I look at it like this. There's a time where, when I used to do music production, where I was the audio engineer. So I was in there setting up the mics. I was cutting up the files. I was optimizing and those types of things. And then I became the manager. And I knew that I was good at setting up the mics and doing all those other things. But there came a time where I had to step back and say, well, that's not my role anymore.
Right.
And I need to let the new audio engineer. I need to let them do that because I need to step back and be able to get, say, okay, you know what? We need to produce 20 high-quality pieces of audio content this week. Okay? So I need to be talking to these people over here that are writing those pieces. I need to be setting the So my role had changed. And if I let my insecurities get the best of me, my fear of my role changing would have made me revert back to those things that I was familiar with. And then I would disenfranchise the new audio engineer.
Yeah.
And ultimately would not all of everything, all of the overall quality of what I was trying to do was going to suffer because of that.
Mm.
And so, you know, I think a lot of times that micromanagement comes in is really the cause of that is, and I'm speaking from my own experience, is really an insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
That we haven't adequately addressed in ourselves. So really being able to let other people do their job. And by the same token, you still have to do some due diligence,
right?
That making ensuring that they can do the job.
Right.
But once you do that due diligence, then you have to let them really ultimately succeed or fail on their own.
Yeah, man. We, you know, I like to say trust but verify, but trust but verify. So I'm going to just kind of sum this up real quick. Here's what I heard about these don'ts, because I want people to really get this. It helps me. It helps us as leaders really ask the question, am I doing that? And so here we go. Carl shared with us, don't be opposed to criticism. Don't claim to know everything. Don't micromanage to the extent it makes your team feel like what they do doesn't matter. And then finally, to cap that off, don't be insecure, right? So all of the other things that you see as symptoms is what Carl is saying is really a byproduct of insecurity, not really addressing that insecurity. Such good stuff, such good stuff. And so, hey, let's get a little bit into kind of what you guys are doing at E for Youth. I really want to highlight some of that stuff. So what's the one big thing you guys are working on right now, Carl, that gets you all excited?
Well, the biggest thing that we're working on right now is we just have taken our employability curriculum. That's a series of team building, critical thinking, media literacy lessons that can be embedded in any classroom. So we have language arts and science teachers and audio video technology teachers that are implementing these lessons as a part of their class. And what they really do is that they get students out of their seats, and they also provide the teachers and the students with some insights into how they view themselves, how do they work in teams, how does stress affect or impact their performance in certain tasks, and providing them with some tools to be able to overcome those obstacles that may keep them from really being as successful as they could. Well, the big thing for us that we're excited about is we've taken that curriculum, now we have that online, and we've put it into a learning management system where it's our process for working with students has become gamified. So as students show proficiency in team building, critical thinking, media literacy, and ultimately what we do is it's about content creation, whether that be video and audio production, visual design, photography, coding, journalism, social media. We have a rubric that allows teachers and the college-age mentors that we train as coaches that go into after-school classes to really review the students' work and be able to show those kids what it takes to create high-quality content. But from the educational standpoint, how do you exhibit higher-level thinking skills? How do you make it evident that you are synthesizing and evaluating? Educators call that Bloom's taxonomy,
mm-hmm.
where you're using higher order thinking skills and you're exhibiting those things. We're excited about the curriculum and the enrichment that we're offering because it really starts to cement the ecosystem that we have been developing and is essentially a blueprint that we can start to replicate and scale really in any city in the world.
Sweet, 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 man. I'm looking forward to that reach. And it sounds like a phenomenal platform that you're creating there that's going to help a whole lot of people. Before we let you go, Carl, if you could talk to little Carl and give him a piece of advice, what would that advice be?
We all have things that come easy to us. And a lot of times, because we have that natural aptitude, we tend to discount those things. And we tend to focus on what we do not have. And I guess I'll tell a little Carl is that embrace those strengths that you do have now.
Mm.
Identify those strengths now and put in, as Malcolm Gladwell says, your 10,000 hours.
Right.
Put it in early. Then you can reap the benefits for the rest of your life.
Yes. Carl, share one book that you've read that has had a lasting impact on the way you approach your work?
I think there are a couple of books. One was the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I read while I was in college. Some people may know about the whole life of Malcolm X, and other folks may not. I highly recommend that book. As I read that while I was in college, it really had a profound impact on me. Another book that actually my mother gave to me, and I think she even put a $100 bill in the back flap of it.
Sweet.
Just to see if I would read it. But that was Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yes, good one.
Book. It's had a profound effect on how I see the world and how I see myself and my trajectory over the next 15, 20 years.
Nice. I like that one. And Carl, tell us where we can go learn more about you and your organization.
Well, you can go online to e4youth.org, eforyouth.org. And you can learn all about us there. We're also on social media on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter.
Fantastic. So folks, head over to faithfactorimpact.com. We will have Carl Settles, his show notes page, and all of the ways that you can connect with him. And as we always say, the difference between the you now and the you later are the people you meet and the books you read. And you've been hanging out with Carl Settles and Jay Everline. And Carl, we are so thankful for all that you're doing in the community, the impact that you're having, and thrilled that you joined us on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you, and you made me think about some stuff here today. So thank you.
Sweet. Folks, once again, head over to faithfactorimpact.com. Check out the show notes page. Reach out to e4youth.org. Get involved where you can. And until next time, let's go make an impact.